Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, part of the New Books Network. This week, we're going to be talking to Professor Paola Bertucci about her new book, Artisanal Enlightenment, Science and the Mechanical Arts in Old Regime France, out this year from Yale University Press. Paola Bertucci is Associate Professor of History in the History of Medicine at Yale University.
Welcome, Paola, to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society.
Hi, Lance. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into your book, I'd like to ask you a little bit about how you came to this project and your background as a scholar of the history of science.
Sure. So I am a scholar of the 18th century. In particular, I'm interested in science, technology, and medicine during the 18th century in Europe, mostly France, Britain, and Italy. And my previous work focused on the public culture of science, on scientific spectacles, the involvement of the human body in experimentation. And when I started working on 18th century France, I, as anyone else who works on science in the 18th century in France, came across a mysterious society called the Société des Arts, the Society of the Arts, that was mostly composed of artisans, not exclusively, but mostly. And there were very few sources. And this society was, as I said, known to various scholars, but it was impossible to tell a broader story about it just because the sources were so few. In parallel, I was working on an 18th century physicist who was very popular at the time and who had been a member of this society. And I was very lucky. One day, a mathematician based in France emailed me saying that he had found a private archive in Germany with lots of documents related to the Société des Arts, and that he'd been allowed to go to Germany, take photos of the documents. And he wanted to know if I'd be interested in co-authoring an article with him on the Société des Arts based on these new documents. And this was very, very exciting to me. So of course I accepted. And as I started working on these documents, I realized that beyond the Société des Arts, there was something larger that I wanted to explore and that these documents were pointing to, which had to do with this particular figure, historical figure, who was an artisan in the sense that he lived on the work of the hands. At the same time, he was learned and did not understand himself as other artisans. He defined himself as artiste, so they use in 18th century documents, letters, books, they use the word artiste, which could be translated as artist, but in a very different sense than we do today. So the artist was a learned artisan, an artisan endowed with esprit. Esprit in French is a very difficult word to translate. It basically captures qualities such as wit, discernment, politeness, judgment. And so by defining themselves as artisans with esprit, these artists were really saying that not only could they make important devices, think about machines, very important machines, scientific instruments, but they were also contributing to knowledge making. And therefore, they could offer the French state a kind of expertise that not even the savant, the equivalent of scientists today, could offer, because they were so grounded in theory, so interested in theory, that they lose sight of the material limitations and material possibilities that working with the hands offered. And so I wrote the article with this French colleague whom I never met in person. And then I asked him if it was okay for him if I went on writing a book that would use these documents and then go beyond with the idea of foregrounding the world of the mechanical arts in the history of the Enlightenment. He, of course, was happy with this. And this is how it all came about.
And so in the book, you write that this idea of the artiste and the society of the arts really comes out in opposition to how savants were talking about the arts prior. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how the arts were conceived in the late 17th century in France?
Yes. So in late 17th century France, something very important happens, which is the establishment of one of the first scientific academies in Europe, the French Academy of Sciences. And members of these Academy of Sciences were mathematicians, astronomers, chemists. They were people who, they were savants, in other words, learned people who did not make a living out of the work of their hands. Artisans, who on the contrary made a living on the work of their hands, were excluded explicitly from membership in the Academy of Science. Now, this academy had a very important role in the French state, because it was established by the French Prime Minister Jean-Baptiste Colbert, who had a vision for the French state in coordination, in collaboration with the French king, that at the time was the Sun King, Louis XIV. And so Colbert believed that this Academy of Sciences would contribute to making France, establishing France as a leader in commercial and imperial enterprises. And so he understood that science, scientific knowledge, as very important to the colonial and imperial projects of the French state. And that's why he established the Academy of Science as an institution of the state. Members were salaried, unlike the equivalent case in Britain, where we have the Royal Society, whose members were not paid by the British Crown. Whereas in France, these academicians were paid by the state, and they could not make money from other activities. And so artisans were excluded. And what happens in the course of the early history of the French Academy of Sciences is that Colbert asked its members to focus on the world of the mechanical arts, of the crafts, arts and crafts that exist mostly in France, though not exclusively. And so one of the first projects that these academicians are asked to complete is an encyclopedia of the arts and crafts. The idea being that you could write down everything that needs to be known on the crafts and arts that exist in France. And the aim of this work was twofold. On the one hand, it was the preservation of knowledge in the sense that all these crafts and arts would be written down, would be described in writing and through illustrations. So this technical knowledge would not get lost, unlike previous knowledge, ancient knowledge that had been lost, that got lost. For example, they had in mind the fallen empires, the big empires like the Roman empires and all the works of engineering that to a large extent, the knowledge of which to a large extent had gotten lost. And so on the one hand, these encyclopedic projects would fulfill the goal of preserving technical knowledge. On the other hand, these projects would also establish the best practices. And so they would promote emulation in artisans and craftsmen who would refer to these works and look up to these works as the best way of making the particular artifacts that individual artisans were making. And it's very interesting that these projects are taken seriously by a number of academicians. At the same time, they are incredibly difficult to complete. And they are difficult to complete in part because these academicians were not practicing artisans themselves. And so they had to find ways of getting this knowledge from artisans. And so they entered workshops, they talked to artisans, and they represented artisans as people who were incredibly confused when it came to articulating in words their own practice, how they made things, even the tools that they were using. They say, the academicians say that artisans use the same term to indicate several tools or many words to indicate the same tool. So this is a motif that will be in the most famous encyclopedia of the 18th century, which is Diderot's and D'Alembert's encyclopedia, that very much is in continuity with these encyclopedic projects pursued initially by the Academy of Sciences. And so we have this incredible difficulty in completing these encyclopedic projects. And there is a lot of work that is carried out by academicians. At the same time, is never published because it's never complete. And this is when words about these encyclopedic projects and research goes out in Paris, and artisans, learned artisans, start to understand that there is an interest on the part of the French state on their own art, and they think they should be the ones who produce this kind of written work, not the academicians who are not really, who don't really have the expertise to understand how artisanal practice actually works. So your question is artist and savant. So with the artisans becoming more and more aware of this interest on the part of the French state in their practices, in their crafts, in their arts, there is this tension between the theory inclined academician who can write and can write well because they have the kind of education that allows them to write well, at the same time can really understand what is going on in a workshop. And the artist, the learned artisan who presents himself as the one who can write, maybe not as well as the savant, at the same time, they can write about their own art because they are educated and they are practicing artisans. And so the artist presents himself as someone who is different at once from the savant, because the savant knows only the theory. At the same time, the artist is more than an artisan because the artisan cannot write, is not polite, does not have esprit. And so there is all this flourishing of publications authored by artists, by artisans, by learned artisans, who that describe their own art. At the same time, while describing, they're also representing the artist as someone whose knowledge, whose expertise is very useful to the French state, exactly because the artist can produce the best machines that the French state needs, the best materials that the French state needs to pursue these projects of imperial expansion, imperial, commercial, colonial expansion. So think, for example, of methods for finding longitude at sea, or materials and methods for producing anchors that would not break, and other things, weapons, and other things like this that the artist really think they can, it's not just that they can make, but they can articulate the rules for making these objects the best possible way. And so writing is not just a description of existing practices. Writing is very important for defining the state of the art, the best practice, something that anyone else should emulate, should strive to do. And so this is why the artist feels so challenged by the savant's interest in the mechanical arts. They feel that the representation the savant may offer in these encyclopedic projects that does not really capture the best practice.
Yeah, and related to that is the idea of innovation and invention, and how new ideas come about, how practices get improved. What's the difference between the ways that savants are thinking of improvement and the ways that the artists are conceiving it?
Yes, this is a very important notion. So improvement is not the same as innovation at this time. And that's very important, even though it's difficult for us to understand, because we tend to conflate the two terms. Improvement really is, for 18th century authors on the art, so whether academicians or artisans, the way they understand improvement is really this notion of taking any craft to the best possible level. They call it, in French, they don't even use the word improvement. The French would be the perfecting of the art. So this idea that each art can reach its best potential through research on materials, best practices, best training of artisans, or best apprenticeship, etc. Innovation, on the other hand, is something that is new. And new, and this is something the artist really underscore more and more, you know, often, very often, the new is something that is easy to achieve. Anyone, they say, can be an inventor. Anyone can contribute something that no one else has done before. But is this useful? So the key word that distinguishes in the end, improvement from innovation is usefulness. Improvement is made of two very important components. One, and they are really equally important, one is the preservation of knowledge. So nothing that we know about artisanal practice should get lost. That is very important. The second thing is innovation. But innovation, so invention, something that is new, but is new and useful at the same time. If you can combine these two things, then you do have the perfection of the art, of any art. You do have improvement. And this is often articulated with the French state in mind. So what these learned artisans are trying to achieve is getting the French state, getting positions for themselves in the offices of the French state, where decision making happens about, for example, technological development happens. So there is, in particular, one office that is called the Bureau of Commerce, where decisions about the crafts are made. And no artisan was allowed to serve in these offices. On the contrary, the Bureau of Commerce relied on the expertise of the academicians, of savants, in order to make decisions. And these learned artisans saw that as a very dangerous practice, because they thought that academicians were not qualified to evaluate inventions, because they were often struck by the new, by something that was new, and they did not realize that it was new, yes, but it was at the same time useless. And I'll give you a very famous example, and I think it makes this very clear. This has to do with the problem of finding longitude at sea. This is a very important problem for imperial powers at the time. It's very important to know where you are at sea. And you use two coordinates. One is called latitude. The other one is longitude. Latitude is easy to find. You need some astronomical instruments. Longitude is complicated, and there was no chronometer at the time, which is what you really need, at least according to our knowledge today, to find longitude. And this was an open problem. The British Crown had established a prize for someone who would solve the problem of finding longitude at sea. The French state had not done similar things, but many watch and clockmakers were working on this. And the problem was that you cannot keep time at sea, because if you use a pendulum clock, for obvious reason, you cannot guarantee that the pendulum will keep time as it should because of the vibrations and the movement of the ship. If you have a watch, given the technology and the materials of the time, you will lose the time soon because of the humidity, of friction, the composition, the very composition of watches. And so Huygens, a scientist, mathematician, a natural philosopher, Christian Huygens, came up with a mathematical solution to this problem. He noticed that a mathematical curve called cycloid was such that if a pendulum could be made to oscillate along this curve rather than along a circle as a pendulum would normally do, then even in at sea, so on a ship where the oscillations would change in amplitude, period of oscillation would stay the same. This basically means that if you can build a pendulum that moves along a cycloid, you can keep track of the time that you spent aboard from the moment you left the first place to the moment when you're reading the time. And this is basically what you need, together with a few other things, to find longitude at sea. So on paper, this was a brilliant solution. And there was almost an obsessive attempt at building the clock that would make the pendulum move along this cycloid. And then what we find in writings by artists is a criticism of this emphasis on the cycloid, because they say the amount of gears we would need to make a pendulum oscillate along a cycloid would make it so pointless, so useless, that it's just a waste of time to focus on this problem. So the solution should come from something else, and they had a few ideas, and they wanted the French state to support their ideas by instituting not a prize of the same kind as the one that the British Crown had established, but an incentive, sort of financial support for groups of artisans who would dedicate themselves to this research. So the difference being that these artists criticize the notion that invention comes from individual people, from ingenious individuals. Inventions occur every time in workshops, but it's up to the ingenious artisan to understand when that particular invention is useful, and also to rely, the ability to rely on other artisans' work. So they see this as a collective enterprise where different kind of expertise, for example, if you need to build a watch that would keep time for extended time periods, you don't need only a watchmaker, you need also a goldsmith, other artisans who work on metals, because they would provide the expertise on materials that you need. So it's a different understanding of research, where different kinds of expertise come together with the same goal of finding a solution. So it's a sort of teamwork, a project based work that these artisans are envisioning. Their project, this kind of state-funded research project, never happens in France. And as it is well known, the problem of longitude would be solved in England by John Harrison. So, but much later, whereas in these early moments, we are talking about the 1720s here, 1720s and 30s, so much earlier, there was this attempt of making longitude a problem that could be solved by teamwork.
Yeah, and so keeping that in mind, I'm thinking a bit about the formation of the Society of Arts and how it becomes defined which arts are included. For instance, are there arts that are not improvable, or for some reason are not included within the society, such as I'm thinking animal husbandry or midwifery or cabinet making or something?
Yeah, this is a very important question. So this is one of the underlying themes of the book. So when you have the composition of a society, but also when you have an encyclopedic project, what gets included is almost less interesting than what gets excluded, or, you know, what gets excluded is as interesting as what gets included. And so in the choices of the Société des Arts, we see really some priorities, striking priorities. And so, for example, one priority is watch and clock making, and this is not a coincidence, of course, but also a number of arts that are related to navigation. So all these activities that would serve the French state. So it's not a coincidence that we don't have all the crafts represented. We don't have pharmacy, for example, a very powerful guild in Paris at the time, and this is completely absent from the Société des Arts. So the attempt there was not to put together every single art or craft, but rather to create some new connections among the crafts and some branches of natural knowledge, for example, astronomy or chemistry. The other possibility, I haven't found enough sources to explicitly say this, but I'm in a footnote here and there, I do suggest that another possible a goal of the Société, at least a group of Société members, was to pursue alchemical projects, alchemical work, really with the idea of transmuting base metals into gold. And this was very tempting at a time of financial disaster. These are the years that follow the financial bubble initiated by John Law, who was the equivalent of a finance minister for France. And the regent at the time, we don't have a king, we have a regent, Duke d'Orléans. He believed in alchemy, he worked as an alchemist himself, and he appointed the director of the Royal Mint in Paris, who was an alchemist too. He appointed this alchemist as director of the Mint, and then he's also a member of the Société des Arts, together with a number of assayers and other chemists who are involved with alchemy. So it's very tempting to see, at least for a few years, the Société as this secret association of people who were carrying out alchemical work on behalf, possibly, of the regent. I don't think that this is the full story of the Société. On the contrary, I think the Société was doing a lot of work that was not secret at all. But it's another possibility.
So then why did the Society of the Arts not last?
Yes, this is another wonderful question. So the Société des Arts was emulating was trying to achieve the status that the Academy of Science had. In other words, the Société des Arts wanted to become an academy, an institution of the state, possibly with salaried members, just like the academicians. And at the beginning of its existence, the members were right in having that hope, because the Société obtained the status of Société. Société was a title that was conferred to associations that could potentially become academies. The academies in France were, in Paris at least, were sponsored by the state. So there was an optimistic moment. They also had a patron, the Comte de Clermont, who was the head, so to speak, of the Société des Arts. But in the course of time, the expectation that the Société would become an academy started to wane for many reasons. It would be too long to list here, contingent in part, but also intrinsic to the composition of the Société. The Société was made mostly by these artists, self-defined artists, so learned artisans, and they introduced some practices of discrimination internal to the Société, basically, that were at odds with the rules of, or rather with the ethos of collaboration that the Société was advocating. And so this discrimination was carried out in particular against artisans who were not regarded as artists, whose craft was not regarded as equally relevant to the imperial and economic expansion of the French state. And so paradoxically, the Société des Arts, that presents itself as this incredibly open-minded association where artisans work together with savants and together with noble, with aristocrats, with the common goal of producing useful knowledge, useful for the French state, paradoxically, it ends up being a place where individual artisans pursue the old trajectory, the old story of social ascent at the expense of this collaborative ethos that they had introduced in the public sphere, basically. And so the society collapsed on itself. It has a long life, it's much longer than previously known, I document in the book, but it does undermine itself because it suffers from this paradox. You know, the artist really captures this paradox. On the one hand, he is and I use the pronoun, the masculine here, because these are all men. There is no explicit exclusion of women, but it is a homosocial space where only men are allowed, not allowed, but where only men work and meet. So the artist, on the one hand, is advocating for the work of the hand. He's saying that by using the hand and the senses in general, artisans have a special knowledge and they can contribute in unique ways to the expansion of the French state, to the projects of the French state. At the same time, they are also saying, they are also pursuing career goals. They are also pursuing, they are trying to get better positions for themselves, better social status in a society that is very static. It's very uncommon for an artisan to become don't even say a nobleman, even though in rare cases it did happen, but even to serve the state in any formal function. But there were privileged positions, like being the clockmaker to the king, being lodged at the Louvre, where special artisans and artists worked without having to subscribe to the rules of the guild. So artisans knew that if you could distinguish yourself in this society, you would individually benefit and benefit a lot. And so on the one hand, there is this collective pursuit, but then in the end, it breaks down to individual trajectories and the pursuit of individual advantages and privileges. And so it really, the Société as a collective project collapses.
Yeah. And as we get then deeper into the 18th century, machines, and especially manufacturing machines, begin to play a larger role in the manual arts. How do these play into the politics of technical knowledge?
Sorry, I didn't hear the question.
We might have cut out a little bit. As we get deeper into the 18th century, machines, and especially manufacturing machines, begin to play a larger role in the manual arts. How did these play into these politics of technical knowledge?
Yes. So what I do in the last section of the book, I analyze how these political epistemology of the artist really carries over even when the Société des Arts doesn't exist anymore, and yet former members do produce some technological innovations, significant technological innovations that really materialize conceptions of humans, for example, or labor, or other artisans that were already in place in the Société des Arts. And so to give you an example, we have Jacques Vaucanson, who is still celebrated today as this ingenious inventor of automata initially, and then machines for the manufacture of silk and other textile that automated processes of production. And he's often described as a genius ahead of his time, and if his projects failed, it is because no one could understand him. What I see instead in his case is really this materialization of a conception of work men and work women here as de-skilled labor. So what Vaucanson does when he becomes inspector of silk manufacturers, so he's one of those people who do achieve a position in French offices, in the offices of the French state. He has a formal appointment as inspector of the silk manufacturers, which means that he oversees the production. He makes sure that silk is produced according to rules that the French state states. And so he produces a number of machines and inventions related to the manufacture of silk. When we look closely at what these machines were actually doing, these machines were taking the mechanizing work, but at the same time they were taking manual skills out of the body of artisans and placing them in the machine. I give you an example. The production of silk threads was a very complex process that required the skill of very young women, because it needed thin fingers. It really relied on this knowledge. Often in texts of the time describing this art, we find an emphasis on the knowledge of the fingers, the knowledge of these spinner's fingers, the hands of the spinners as knowing hands, we find. And it was really up to the spinner to understand what to do in the moment. So it was very difficult to automatize the process because it was so much unpredictable. And so, and in fact, spinners were very well rewarded for their work when they were so skilled as to make high quality silk threads. And so what Vaucanson does, he observes how spinners work. He tries to understand what is exactly that they do that can be transferred to the machine so as to make the spinner's work repetitive and replaceable. And so this is what his machines do. They reimagine basically the work of spinning and even the role of the machine itself, making sure that the worker, the spinner, would not need to be present in the moment and use their own bodily, embodied knowledge, embodied skill. Anyone could do it because now it is the machine that is in charge of the process by, you know, means of, you know, with various mechanical inventions, innovations that he introduced, that Vaucanson introduces. And it's very interesting for me to think about this transformation, this new vision of the spinner of workers, in light of riots that had happened years earlier when Vaucanson, for the first time, introduced the new machine for the manufacture of silk that elicited this incredible reaction on the part of producers and spinners who really reject this invention. He has, that happens in Lyon. He has to flee Lyon disguised as a monk because his life had been threatened. These workers, in association with producers, manufacturers of silk, wanted to kill him because they understood that if his machine were introduced, then their own economy, the whole system that made sure their life could continue to be what it was, would be completely undermined. And so the first attempt that was 1744 fails in this very glowing, in a sense, in this very striking way. And then Vaucanson does not give up, but he understands that in order to prevent this kind of riots, he needs to silence the workers by depriving them of what they have, you know, the value that they have in their hands. And so by de-skilling their work, he makes sure that anyone can be replaced. No one is really essential. Now it's the machine that has the front stage. It's the machine that is ingenious. It's no longer the artist per se. So I see this as a very intriguing materialization of these discriminatory practices or epistemologies even of the artists that saw themselves as different from other artisans. And in fact, in the writing, artists really, they're really dismissive of artisans and craftsmen. They say that craftsmen work without using their mind. They don't need their mind. It's just rote practice what they do, whereas artists always use their mind in coordination with the senses, and so they have this particular kind of intelligence. And so I see in Vaucanson's machine really materialization of this idea of workers as basically machines, we would say today.
Mm-hmm. So as we're getting closer to the end of the interview, I'm wondering, how do you think this history of the Society of the Arts and of the artisan crafts in general, how it reflects on the bigger themes of the Enlightenment?
So rather than reflecting the bigger themes of the Enlightenment, what I wanted to do here was to change perspective on the Enlightenment. So I'm not trying to redefine the Enlightenment. I am offering a new point of view on the Enlightenment, which is not my own, is the artist's point of view. So I am foregrounding this figure that had never been properly identified before as these learned artisans who doesn't see himself as a savant or as an artisan. And foreground also the world of the mechanical arts as this place where new conceptions of useful knowledge emerge, where useful really means something that goes hand in hand with the commercial and imperial colonial expansion of the state. So it's also a contribution to the history of encyclopedism. So what counts as knowledge in the 18th century, this is best epitomized by the Encyclopédie by Diderot and D'Alembert. I show that the Encyclopédie is actually a point of arrival, not a starting point, but is the point of arrival of these previous incomplete projects. And the Encyclopédie itself borrows a lot from these artists' work, you know, published work on the mechanical arts. And so I think in the end, what we see is that I would like for us to think of the Enlightenment not just as a philosophical movement, but also as a set of practices of inclusion and exclusion.
So, Paul, last question then. What are you going to work on next?
Oh, okay. So I would like to continue to explore artisanal knowledge in two main ways. One is to look at how some artisans, and again, these are artisans or learned artisans, talk about their own education. So what is it that they do to inspire their own work? So what kind of experiences are they seeking? What kind of experiences do they offer each other? What kind of collecting practices do they have? And what is the place for the circulation of this knowledge? And then the other project I have, still related to artisans and artisanal culture, is the first articulation of diseases of artisans. So in 1700, we have the publication of the first treatise dedicated to diseases of workers by Bernardino Ramazzini. He's an Italian physician, and this text was incredibly popular. It gets translated into many languages. It is originally published in Latin, which means that it was read well beyond Italy, but is also translated into many other European languages well into the 20th century, when the Institute of Occupational Medicine was first established. So I want to understand a little bit more about how this physician went about collecting his knowledge about diseases of artisans. We have similar rhetoric on the physician who enters artisans' workshops and homes to ask about what they do, the kind of environment they move in, and the kind of materials that they touch and breathe and absorb through their skin. So it's another way of representing the artisanal world of the early modern period that intrigues me very much, and I, you know, this is what I will do next.
Well, I very much look forward to reading more of your work on artisans. So, Paola, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Lance. This has been great.